Before we got involved, water collected in the Kissimmee River Basin north of Lake Okeechobee and flowed south into the lake. It then spilled over the lake's south shore and flowed slowly south through the Everglades, eventually into Florida Bay. But that's no longer how the system works, and ecosystems are suffering because of that. So for the rest of today's show, we're going to try to get a big picture view of how we wound up where we are today and what solutions might be found as we move forward. I'm joined in studio by Rae Ann Wessel. She is the Natural Resource Policy Director for the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation. Rae Ann, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Julie.
And I'm also joined by Eric Eichenberg. He's the CEO of the Everglades Foundation. Eric, thanks for your time as well.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
You are welcome to join our conversation with a comment or a question by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So, Rae Ann, for starters, do you have any thoughts on what we just heard from John Campbell?
Absolutely.
Like, which thought would you like to hear first?
So the political will, as far as moving projects faster, shortening maybe that 30 or 50 year time frame, these aren't limited by our understanding of the system. They are truly political will and the will of the people to push for what we need to get accelerated and built. In fact, in the past several years, we've moved from a 10-year planning process to a 3-year planning process. And one of the highlights of this Everglades storage reservoir we're talking about today is that's been done in basically about a year. So speeding up that process when we have a lot of the fundamentals understood is one way that we can accelerate the getting things on the books. But there will have to still be the funding both at the state and federal level.
So. It seems, though, like I'm hearing a lot of things loosening up. I mean, we have the federal restoration of the dike money, and then we have the local EAA, right? So it's getting there.
We're living in a wonderful time for progress being made and projects getting started. And in fact, this year and next year, some projects getting finished. So they're all parts of this puzzle. You've got to open up the bottom of the bathtub or the southern end of the Everglades to allow water to flow and not back up. That's got to happen before you can move more water south out of Lake Okeechobee. And these are all – there are a whole series of projects that are accelerating. Tamiami Trail, the C-111. SEP, this project, the Southern Reservoir, and we're moving forward with comments on the northern storage. So there's a lot going on right now.
There's so many cogs in this wheel. Eric, I wanted to ask your impressions. What did you think about the conversation with John Campbell we just had?
Well, I think it's here we go again. It's Groundhog Day again along the west coast, southwest coast, the Treasure Coast, Lake Okeechobee. I mean, the fact that we have discharges is nothing new because we have an antiquated infrastructure program on how we're moving water around. But what's added insult to here to injury is the algae and the fact that we have massive nutrient pollution that's pouring into Lake Okeechobee. And when we have warm temperatures like we do in the summer, algae grows, and we see these shameful and ridiculous photographs and videos and accounts that we see on both sides. So, you know, John is in a difficult position because the colonel and the Army Corps has one option today, is that when the lake rises, they dump the water east and west. And if this water was clean, if this was a clean lake and not Florida's largest septic tank, which it is today, then you would still have an issue of blasting too much fresh water east and west. Estuaries have to have that balance of fresh water and salt water. But again, when we have projects, as Rae Ann has mentioned, and we're seeing momentum, the nutrient pollution is really what's raising people's concerns, getting folks motivated. And in my view, the turning point was in 16 when realtors, small business owners, anglers, boat manufacturers all stood up and said, enough, enough. And again, here we are, algae, health departments telling people to stay out of the water. We must do something. The good news is we're moving things forward here. These projects finally connecting Okeechobee to the Florida Keys, we're making progress.
We're making progress, but it just doesn't seem like it's fast enough when you look out at the canal and you've got guacamole floating out there.
Right.
You know?
Right. It's not going to happen overnight, unfortunately. But, you know, we're dealing with decades of ignorance, decades of non-action. And, again, the people stood up in 16. Listen, the fact that a reservoir south of Lake was just approved by the White House, it was in record time. And again, it was because the amount of people that said we have to do something and folks need to continue to be engaged.
And I think on that point, it's important to understand that we're operating a last century flood control project operation in the 21st century reality. It doesn't work that way. There have to be changes made. And some of the opportunities with the governor issuing an emergency order lift or cover some of the alterations to the way the Corps and Water Management District can operate the system. And I think that there are some things that we have not seen them do yet with fallow cropland, with cropland that's just sitting in the EAA unaffected by this current flood and the algae, that could reduce the damage dramatically to the estuaries.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Mike is calling in on the road to Lake Placid. Mike, what would you like to ask?
The elevations that are involved are no secret. If that dike wasn't there, the Herbert Hoover dike wasn't there, and the water was allowed to go, how many people are actually affected? Are roads like 75 going to be inundated for parts of the year? Or because the East Coast is completely protected by the dike that it has in the local canal system, who's that dike actually protecting?
That's a good question, and that gets us into the entire history of how things have been modified down there. So thank you so much, Mike, for your question, and I'll have you listen to it off the phone, listen to it on the radio. So, Rayanne, I want to ask you, when did the modification begin and why? It was alluded to by John earlier, but tell me a little bit about the history lesson on this.
So the history is that the major portion of the Southern Peninsula is dominated by what we call the Greater Everglades ecosystem. It starts up in Orlando with a marsh up to 3 miles wide back in the 1880s, before the 1880s, that would flood. It was like an Everglades system. Drop of water that fell out of the sky would take 6 to 8 months to get into Lake Okeechobee with a 40-foot drop in elevation. From Lake Okeechobee, the water would swell across the landscape, and then that raised water would flow south into the Everglades, where it's much flatter. It would take 16 months to go about the same distance to get down to the Southern Peninsula.
So if there were not a dike on the south end of Lake Okeechobee?
Well, today we've changed the system dramatically. Of course, the hurricanes that happened in the 1920s, there was a 1926 and 1928 hurricane that occurred during a very wet decade that decimated the population and the farms and everything that was in the Everglades. That prompted the construction of the dike to protect lives, because there were thousands of people's lives lost, as well as cattle and crops as well.
Farmland and property, yeah.
So then in building a dike around Lake Okeechobee, you effectively cut off all flow to the Everglades and forced the water somewhere else. That somewhere else was the Caloosahatchee, the western Everglades that used to wrap around the western side of the lake, was really just like Everglades marsh with a series of lakes till it hit the waterfall at the western edge of Lake Flirt and flowed into the Caloosahatchee.
So the Caloosahatchee wasn't originally connected to the lake?
No, not at all. Just by this plateau of western Everglades until it dropped off about 4 to 10 feet at the waterfall at Lake Flirt, at a place called Fort Thompson, that fed the Caloosahatchee proper. But the changes really began in the 1880s when a man named Hamilton Diston made a deal with the governor to drain the swamp. It was the first draining of the swamp. And he connected a series of lakes up in the Kissimmee Valley. And instead of just having this Everglades system, channelized portions of that came out of the lake with a channel called the Three Mile Canal that connected west to Lake Hickpachee in that western Everglades, and then through to eventually getting to Lake Flirt, dynamiting the waterfalls, and connecting to the Caloosahatchee. The idea was to make more arable land available. They mm-hmm. didn't understand the value of wetlands, thought that there were health problems that were created by wetlands, didn't understand the
function. Well, after getting hit by the mosquitoes in the wetlands, I can see how people might question their value.
Right.
No, I'm just joking. But to his question, though, how many people are protected, basically, by the fact that dike exists.
You have the communities of Clewiston, South Bay, Belglade, and Pahokee that are agricultural communities along with the operations of that area that have been developed over the decades since that dike was constructed. There were people farming those rich mucklands when the 20s hurricanes hit because that was free fertilizer.
Oh,
that was
good
great,
dirt, yeah.
Great soil. We became the winter vegetable crop for the nation. The problem is once you put up the dike, then you've actually controlled water in a very artificial way, not understanding that the continued operation would cause loss of soil and peat in the Everglades and force water different directions. So those different directions became this designated navigation channel to the west coast in the Coosawhatchie, and the creation of one in the east coast that never existed in any form, the St. Lucie Canal. That had to be upgraded further in the 1940s after the 1940s flood that hit central Kissimmee Valley. And that's when the Coosawhatchie was dredged to its current configuration of a quarter of a mile wide and 25 feet deep, a real discharge point, not a river per se, a real canal.
A lot of man manipulating nature being discussed here.
It is. We knew better. We had a better idea. We really didn't understand what we were dealing with.
Yeah. Eric, I wanted to turn back to you. Tell me a little bit more about the EAA or the Everglades Agricultural Area. How big is that area and what does that contain? How much of it is actually farmland?
Well, you have about 500,000 acres south of the lake, primarily sugarcane production, cultivated by two major companies. You have some sod farms, rice farms, but it's primarily sugarcane. You have massive canals that run through the EAA, the agricultural area, the Miami Canal, the New River Canal, and those canals will be the source of taking lake water and delivering it to this reservoir once it's constructed. And, you know, the gentleman's question about 75, I heard him correctly, the water will flow south. And when we constructed I-75 heading east to Fort Lauderdale and Miami, those big culverts, as you go about every half mile and the road goes up a little bit, those culverts will deliver water south. And Rayanne mentioned a little bit time ago that the government is building bridges along U.S. 41. This is in an effort to take water again, store it within the EAA in this reservoir. You're not taking any lands out of production. That was a concern last year when the legislature was considering this. So we're using land that is currently owned by the state of Florida. The reservoir will be constructed. The water needs to be cleansed. The state needs to meet a water quality standard in the Everglades, 10 parts per billion of phosphorus, and then that clean water will be delivered south all the way down to Everglades National Park and the Florida Keys.
So, and I mean, I feel like I already know the answer to this. Why is the water needing to be cleaned?
Well, it's high in phosphorus primarily. It's there's nutrients, fertilizers, runoff. You know, north of the lake you have a lot of cattle, dairy farms. There's some citrus up around there. So the fertilizers that are placed to grow crops or to have agricultural lands, that runoff goes into the streams and the water bodies. And when we see, again, an overabundance of that, of phosphorus primarily, that's when we see these algal blooms. The Everglades Foundation, I might add, Julie, is offering $10 million to universities, teams, companies to solve this problem. We have 9 teams that are remaining in a 4-year competition, very excited about moving this competition to Florida here next year. But we need to remove phosphorus from the water, which will reduce these algal blooms that we're seeing on the east and west coasts.
The natural Everglades were a very low-nutrient kind of system, ecologically.
Yeah, anybody who's tried to plant a tomato in their backyard should know that. There's not a whole lot of organic matter naturally there, really, to speak of, for gardening or for farming.
Or nitrogen. And so the legacy nutrients that Eric was just speaking about have overwhelmed the system and exchanged sawgrass for cattails. And so now you've changed an ecological system, enriched it in ways that it's lost its diversity. And by losing its diversity, it loses its function, it loses its wildlife diversity and all the rest. So the effort to clean up water going into the Everglades was established in the 1994 Everglades Forever Act. And so there's a legal binding obligation that we have for water that's needed by the Everglades, but it's got to be clean. So it's got to be less than 10 parts per billion of phosphorus.
When you were here last time, it was probably almost a year ago, and we were talking about the same thing, you know, Groundhog Day, like Eric was saying. You mentioned, I remember we talked a little bit about farming water.
Right, right.
Has that gotten anywhere where people who have farmland are using that land to clean water?
Especially in the St. Lucie Basin, in their watershed, they have the Calkins Water Farm is one large former citrus grove that is now holding water. The district is paying other property owners in a program called the Distributed Water Management Program to hold water. Now, they get paid whether we have a drought or we have a flood, and they are able to help hold some water. So it's one form of a public-private partnership. But the prices that are being paid are very diverse depending on where it is. The program started not targeting those watersheds where we needed the storage, but in basically who was available or willing to partner. So there are some projects that are certainly doing that in the Kissimmee and in the St. Lucie Everglades area.
Mm-hmm. Eric, I know that there's only one Everglades, but is it possible to compare the way that Florida manages its water versus other states or other places?
No, I think, Julie, we're unique in that. You know, it's been referenced here on this during this program that we have infrastructure. We have water infrastructure that was designed 70 years ago for 2 million people, and that same infrastructure remains in place now for 8 to 10 million people, let alone all the tourists that come to Florida. So I think we're unique in that regard. No other state has the amount of water management districts and expertise, quite frankly, that we have here in Florida. But I think we share a common, unfortunately, on the algae. And if you look at the Great Lakes, I was on a call yesterday with officials from the state of Ohio. Lake Erie is once again dealing with toxic water. I was on a phone call last week with officials from the state of New York. There's alga blooms in New York. So they're looking at Florida on how we're handling these issues. And I'll just say that the concern here is unless we get serious on reducing the amount of nutrient pollution, fertilizers, phosphorus and nitrogen coming into Lake Okeechobee, the state of Florida has passed legislation in 2000. There was a deadline of 2015. Unfortunately, we keep kicking the can. We're not addressing the issue north of Lake Okeechobee. The Florida Department of Agriculture is responsible for that, and it's time that they do it, or else we're going to continue to see these summers that are lost. And when we say a lost summer, and people see these pictures and they get disgusted by it, but think about the impact this is having on people's livelihood. Folks that rely on these waterways are having to lay people off, or they're not being able to take people out on charters for fishing. This is a serious issue, and our elected officials in Florida need to deal with the cleanup of Lake Okeechobee, and it needs to start now.
Yeah, and it was interesting because Don from Bukelia, he wants to know, he called in, he said, have there always been massive algae blooms in the lake, or is this just a recent phenomenon? How far back do these algal blooms kind of date? Is it concurrent with intensive farming, or is it more of a warm temperature thing?
I would say that the hurricane certainly suspended all the sediments in this very shallow lake in Hurricane Irma last year. That, in combination with these very warm temperatures, certainly conspire to
make it
exacerbate
worse.
And we're seeing that worldwide. But I would say that we haven't always had algal blooms on the lake. That is something that is becoming more prevalent because the legacy nutrient that's in sediment in the bottom of the lake that continues to come in, particularly from the northeast quadrant of the lake, but certainly in all portions, is causing algal blooms. And that's a big problem because the city of Okeechobee uses Lake Okeechobee as their water supply.
And then also, Eric, I want to go ask you a question. You talk about, you know, and also, Rayanne, you're both talking about water coming from the north and kind of trickling its way in, and these, this is from farming, runoff, all that kind of stuff, how much of the nutrients that are in, is there any way to quantify, how much of the nutrients that are in Lake Okeechobee that shouldn't be there are coming from the water runoff that's coming down from the north, and how much of it is being pumped back in from flooded fields outside?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, our scientists have looked at these numbers, and roughly about 95% of the nutrient pollution into Lake Okeechobee comes from the north. The state of Florida, about 10 years back, stopped the practice of common back pumping of water from the sugar farms into Lake Okeechobee. For decades, that was happening. And then, as Rayanne mentioned, the soil of the lake itself is high in nutrients. So we have to, there's more water flows into Okeechobee than we can get rid of. So as the water is pouring in and it's polluted, steps need to be taken north of Lake Okeechobee. Best management practice that have to be, they need to be real. We need there need to be enforceable permits like we have south of Okeechobee. There needs to be a system set up so that we get serious about dealing with the water that's coming into Okeechobee, and let's remove that pollution. There are ways to do it. Again, we need, as we saw last year, political will of getting the reservoir south of the lake moving. We need that same political will to the north so that we can stop the pollution pouring into Okeechobee.
It's kind of interesting that you talk about the political will. It's just hard to get the political will to move when somebody doesn't have it in their backyard. Are you finding that being kind of the drawback or the difficult selling point, they don't feel as impacted by it?
Well, I think I think they are impacted. We had a Senate president last year who represents a district that was seeing the impact directly in Stewart, Martin County, and Joe Negron stepped up in a big way to move this reservoir forward. But, you know, we're all in this together. Whether you're living in Pensacola or Key West, when you see these pictures coming out of Florida, if you're living in Idaho, Vermont, pick the state, and you have a vacation plan to Florida, you think there's algae all over the state. And folks are canceling trips down here because, again, we're not dealing with the cure to our problem. The algae is a symptom to this issue. Everglades restoration is the cure. You asked John a question earlier about what could be maybe a way to expedite some of this. It is funding. We need to get funding out of Washington. We have the money in Florida thanks to Amendment 1. The Army Corps of Engineers needs to get about $200 million a year so these projects can be built, and they can be built in our lifetime so that we can see a change to the chronic problems that we continue to see now more frequently than we all want.
If you're just joining the show, I'm talking in the studio with Rayanne Wessel. She's the Natural Resource Policy Director for the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation. I'm also talking on the phone with Eric Eichenberg. He is the CEO of Everglades Foundation. We're getting a primer on South Florida's water systems and how we wound up where we are today with massive algae blooms in the Coosawhatchee River and estuary because of the need to release nutrient-rich freshwater, which kind of sounds like an oxymoron, from Lake Okeechobee. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Rayanne, let's talk about stormwater storage and treatment. Is any of that happening north of the lake before it gets there? Or are we just looking at only handling how to get things out down towards the south?
Well, let me answer this in reverse order and use this particular incident that started in May as an example of stormwater treatment that's needed. We had 300% of normal rainfall the last 2 weeks of May, which was very early. It turns out that all of the harmful flows we were getting in the Coosawhatchee side were coming from our watershed, which is almost two Lake Okeechobees in size. But once the releases started from the lake, in putting together our weekly report, I discovered that there was water backflowing. Now, that means gravity flowing towards the lake from the EAA in the L8 Basin and in the Industrial Canal from Clewiston that was the same amount coming into the lake as they were having to discharge out to the two estuaries. This is where we never let a good disaster go to waste. We look at it and try to tease out some of the opportunities that could be there. The argument being that we wouldn't have needed to make these high releases had that water been held on those properties, just like our communities in the urban development have to hold water on stormwater ponds. So this is, again, where the 21st century reality isn't being served by the last century's stormwater control. To the north, so the argument there is all of these properties should be required to hold their own stormwater instead of being able to release it into the lake where we can't get it out fast enough and where that nutrient is building up and exacerbating some of those algal blooms. But to the north, there is only one outlet. It's the lake. So anything that's held north of the lake will help. But what they're discovering, and there's a current plan that is out for comment called the Lake Okeechobee Watershed Restoration Project. What the Corps and Water Management District have determined in the past 2 years approximately of studying this is that there's not enough benefit to build big reservoirs north of the lake, and there isn't land available to do that. So now they're looking at doing lower volume, shallow marshes, treatment areas, aquifer storage and recovery, which is where you put water down into the ground when you have too much, and then you pull it back out when you need it. But it's a much smaller project than I think it was originally envisioned to be. The original plan had 330 wells around Lake Okeechobee of these ASR, aquifer storage and recovery wells. In looking at the situation today, they discovered that probably the landscape can't manage more than 80 to 100 wells. So we're looking at limited capacity to do treatment north unless they look further up the Kissimmee Valley, which is what we've recommended.
So what if all the water was clean? What if people stopped using all of the stuff that makes it dirty?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't we still always have too much water?
We'd still have too much water because we've drained too much of we've ditched and diked and eliminated the wetlands, that up to 3-mile-wide wetland system that once managed water slowly. Now the district is putting those meanders back in and filling in the canal. There's a project called the Kissimmee River Restoration that's due to be finished in 2020. So it won't put it back entirely the way it had been, but for 44 miles of channelized canal that Hamilton Diston helped create, that will be filled in and the water will be allowed to spread out. There needs to be even more capacity for wetland hydrologic marsh restoration up there, but the fact of the matter is gravity will always pull that water into the lake. So if it doesn't have another place to go, you've got to have an outlet out of the lake to help the estuaries. And that's where this EAA reservoir to the south in the Everglades is so critical, because this one project, the EAA reservoir, will allow us to reduce estuary discharges between 40 and 60% based on the modeling that's been done. If you put all the other projects together, you don't get anywhere close to that. And the key is because you can get water out of the lake. So it's south of the lake, it's downstream from the lake and downstream from the Everglades, the estuaries.
And would that possibly help the dried out Everglades?
It would. It would. The ability to send water south would keep that water flowing. Because, Julie, you know, we're talking right now about too much water. We had excess rain in May. There's going to be a time, who knows when, but it could be soon, where this could be a program talking about a severe drought, because we have drought conditions in Florida.
Yeah, that'll be
Florida.
In March.
So,
follow right on.
Yeah, right. And you know, people are going to be told they can't water their lawns and whatnot. So when we talk about Everglades restoration, it is about storage. It's about capacity, as Rayanne mentioned. And these projects from Okeechobee down to the Keys are allowing a water flow to move south. And remember, the Everglades is the water supply for nearly 8 million people now, and that population continues to grow. So we need to get water down to Florida Bay and the Keys, because we're seeing the way we're managing water now, the salt water, the salinity level gets too high, and you have dead seagrass, which impacts that estuary and that economy. So this is Goldilocks. We need to get it just right. And again, the good news is, for the first time in 18 years, We have projects that are reconnecting Okeechobee down to the Keys, and that's where the focus needs to be within the next 5 or so years. And let's finish these projects so we can reduce the amount going east and west and send it down to Florida Bay in the park.
So, Eric, it sounds like you are feeling maybe a little rosier than we are green about the direction we're going. I mean, could this possibly actually be a story about good news?
Yes, I'm extremely optimistic as we move forward here in the next couple of years, because we've turned a corner. This is no longer an environmental issue versus big business. This is all about Florida. This is America's Everglades that are being threatened today. And again, when we have realtors, anglers, boat manufacturers, and everyone in between who relies on this ecosystem for their livelihood, when politicians hear from them and less from Rayanne and myself, that means we're making progress, because, again, the stereotype about this being an environmental issue is lost. It's economics. It's jobs. Florida is now number 3 in the nation with population. We can do better. This is 2018, and we're still dealing with the same issue that we've had now for decades. We're going to fix it. It's this generation that's going to do it, and that's why I'm so optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, Rayanne, Governor Scott, he's recently gotten a little bit more green in his attitude towards things, environmental positions here at the end of his time in office. Do you think he's had a change of heart? Do you think that we're going to be seeing people who are traditionally not so interested in the environment suddenly becoming interested because of the financial implications?
Those financial implications have been there, and they have been one of the talking points during this administration. And one of the reasons that I think we have been able to get more focus on projects and on funding is because we've brought the demonstrated economic impact into this conversation. I think it's really important to understand that actions have consequences. We have had rollbacks in regulations, rollbacks in personnel, and in the capacity of these agencies to do what they are uniquely authorized to do. And that's where you can't separate the two. I mean, you've got to understand that economy and environment and quality all go together, that is something you've got to prioritize.
Particularly as relates to Florida.
Especially.
And the Everglades. We have time for one last call. Linda is calling from Fort Myers. Linda, what would you like to ask?
Hi, good afternoon. Amendment 1 in 2014, overwhelmingly supported by voters. But in Tallahassee, they ignored that and spent the money on anything they wanted to. And then there was a court challenge, and as I understand it, they may fight back against the court's decision. Is that true?
All right, Linda, we'll have your answer off the phone. Thank you for your question. Rayanne, can you address that? I mean, tell me about Amendment 1.
So Amendment 1 was the Florida Water and Land Legacy that was a constitutional amendment passed in 2014 by 75% of Florida voters. And it basically said that 33% of dock stamp taxes, which are collected when on the sale of real estate, would be designated specifically for a purchase of new land, for Everglades restoration, for springs restoration. And the legislature basically said that we didn't understand what we had voted for and that they were doing everything as was appropriate. That challenge was immediately brought to the court system, and just this month a judge in Tallahassee determined that, in fact, no, the legislature had not used the money as was appropriate. The legislature has said they are going to challenge that, and so I think
that's where it stands
we'll
now.
We'll get to see.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that's
Julie.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
if
all right.
I could just add to that.
Sure.
In 2015, as the caller was referencing, the amendment specifically states that those dollars can go towards projects like Everglades restoration. So in 2015, the legislature and the governor passed and signed what's called Legacy Florida, which sets a $200 million amount of funding out of Amendment 1 for Everglades restoration. And those are critical dollars that this project that we've been spending the hour discussing relies upon. So as the appeal and all the issues settle out on this Amendment 1 case, what's imperative from our perspective is that the funding out of Amendment 1 goes directly to the Everglades. That's where the voters called for it, as well as our natural springs and other environmental issues around the state. But in order to get that federal money that John Campbell was talking about, we need to have the state money available, one-to-one match. Amendment 1 is in place right now for the Everglades. We can't lose it.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show, but I want to thank my guest, Rayanne Wessel, Natural Resource Policy Director for the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation. Rayanne, thanks for being here. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate the conversation.
And also Eric Eichenberg, the CEO of the Everglades Foundation. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank my earlier guest, John Campbell, from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, for talking with us in the first part of the show. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.